Hello and thank you for joining us for this local history programme as we go back to the years of the Second World War. When Prime Minister Mr. Robert Menzies went to air on national radio to announce Australia was at war with Germany, the reaction differed with many people.
Perhaps amazement. It just couldn't happen here, but it did happen. And I think from memory, the people responded very well to it. And I think that many lost their sons and husbands. The local Red Cross and the various other people formed clubs for the airmen, and particularly for the airmen, but for any people that were in uniform, and they were well catered for right through the war. And I think that the Toronto people can be very proud of the effort they made to maintain things as near as possible to normal.
Well, to me, they think it seemed worse than the first one, in a way.
Why was that?
I don't know. I always had that feeling, you know. But when you think of all those thousands that, you know, were killed and that, when Albert went, he wasn't at Gallipoli, but he was in Egypt at first, and then to France from there. They went to France, and that's where he spent. He had trench feet, had to go to England with trench feet, and went up to Scotland to friends and met his first wife. She came out later. Lovely person. But at any rate.
For quite a long while, nobody's in the early stages, no one seemed to worry much about the war. They didn't seem to think there was a war on until they bombed Darwin, and then they started to take a little bit of notice. And I think that that was typical of a lot of countries. There was nothing done very much on the Western Front. They were just staying put most of the time.
Harry Frith, Ruby Osborne, and George Dury, looking back to the commencement of World War II. During those years, there was the home front war effort.
Everybody was had to do something or other in connection with the war. If you're in the coal mines, you're in a protected industry. The government got labour gangs. They had them and they sent them to Darwin. They used them all over the place. But you had to do something in connection with the war effort.
A number of restrictions were introduced. One major restriction concerned boating. Harry Bond remembers that only too well.
Well, yes, it was regarding boats. In all the boats on Lake Macquarie were gathered together and quarantined. All the yachts with a mast, they had their masts removed, and they were all taken up Cockle Creek and moored there. And the owners were permitted to just go aboard them to maintain them. All the small crafts, rowing boats and even the little 6 and 8 foot dinghies were all moored or all parked on a piece of land at Bolton Point. Unfortunately, being out in the open for some years, they were of very little use after time was up. Incidentally, when all those boats were locked up in Lake Macquarie, those two yachts permitted to still sail, and Wings, my yacht, was one of them. And the other one was a yacht called Valkyrie, and they were training cadets at the time from the Rathmines base, and they had a big distinguishing bullseye on each side of the boat to distinguish them by.
Harry Bond commenting in this local history program on the war years at Lake Macquarie. In 1938, Mavis Dews married. She was working at the co-op store at that time, and one regulation which affected her was that she had to give up her job.
We were married in 1938. Well, I had a very good job. I hadn't lost any work during the lockout or the depression, and meant as soon as I was married, I had to give up my job, and that's just what happened.
Why did they stipulate that women couldn't work if they married?
Oh, well, women couldn't do work and keep a man out of a job. 12 months after I was married and war had broken out, I was asked to go back to the store, which I did. I went back to my old job because the man that had taken my job couldn't do it.
World War II reopened the coal mines and also introduced a new form of mining. Mick Jurd and George Dury reflect.
Everybody that could produce coal was given. I worked at Ostermere for a little pit down there. Chap owned this place. I built the bathhouse and a lot of buildings around the place. That was financed by the coal board, and that was just a little three or four man pit. Now everybody that had a hole in the ground was got coal out, and the coal board financed them to get every ounce they could.
Open cuts were open during that. Was the first of the open cuts in this district. We had an open cut at Minmore and another one down here at Swansea.
That must have been quite a revolutionary step in coal mining to see the first open cut mine.
The open cut? Oh, yes, it's something entirely different altogether. It did not meet any opposition in those days like they do today from people. People weren't concerned where they dug the coal as long as they got it.
In 1927, Defence Department personnel struck upon the idea to build an air base in Lake Macquarie. It took some years to get things moving, and in 1939, John Newton arrived with an advance party to commence work on establishing Rath Mines.
Well, the purpose as a flying boat base, Rath Mines, was to be flying boat base, would be manned by Sunderland aircraft, which in 1939, number 10 Squadron was formed. They went to England to pick up, I think it was 12 Sunderlands, for number 10 Squadron from the Air Ministry in England. And unfortunately, war broke out, and the English Air Ministry asked them, or the Australian people, could they keep it? Keep the squadron, I mean. Well, you've got a lot of water here, you know. Not on the lake, I mean a lot of water out at sea. And if you've got a flying boat base with reasonable durability where they can go out to sea and survey and patrol reconnaissance aircraft, this is what flying boats are mostly for, well, you can cover a lot of areas you couldn't in those days cover with land planes, because we didn't have very modern land planes either in 1939.
John Newton. Catalina aircraft were required and ordered from America. The craft had to be collected by Australian pilots, but there was a problem. America was a neutral country. Australia was at war with Germany. And a nation at war can't send troops into a neutral country. The solution? Send Qantas pilots to collect the aircraft.
When we found we couldn't get the Sunderlands, well, I suppose it would be the Defence Department, they decided they had to have something, so they looked at America and they looked at the Catalina. Now, the Catalina was a wonderful aircraft. It had such a wonderful range. 28 hours, I think, they stayed up. That's a long range. But they decided they would get them. And unfortunately, we not only didn't have men trained to fly them, but we couldn't send men over there for the simple reason that America wasn't at war. So we had to fly the Qantas, and we got the Qantas pilots to go over and pick them up. They picked up the first 19 Catalinas. After that, America came into the war, and we sent our own men over, our own pilots.
Why couldn't you send your own men to America before she wasn't at war?
Well, she was a neutral country. You can't send armed forces into a neutral country. This applied when I was up around the Dutch East Indies on the West Australia. The Dutch were, this is 1940, they were also neutral. And there was a ship in there, a German ship, called the Scheer. And it's supposed to have £250,000 worth of osmeridium. And we were waiting to come out to capture it. And every time we flew within the 3-mile limit, the Dutch Stornies would go up and bum, 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 bum. They'd go away because we were not going into their territory. You just can't do it. In time of war, a neutral country, a country at war, cannot go into a neutral country.
The Cat has a unique record to its credit.
It was the third aircraft to fly the Pacific. The first two in 1928 was Kingsford Smith and the Southern Cross. And in 1934, the Lady Southern Cross, Kingsford Smith and Arm. They were the only two that ever flown the Pacific either way, and the Catalina was the third.
One of the pilots to operate out of Rath Mines was Lynn Hurd. He looks back to the base as it was in 1942.
It was pretty well developed then. They were just finishing the concrete slipway, which is there now. They still had an old wooden slipway, which they cut into the wharf. We were still bringing the Cats out on the wooden slipway. And then while I was there, as a navigation officer, they finished the concrete slipway and cut off the old slipway into a wharf, which was there until quite fairly recently, but it's gone now.
Linherd flew the cats and has fond memories of them.
Yes. Well, I realised that being a navigation expert, I'd gone through a navigation expert's course and I held a first-class air navigator's licence, so that my chances of getting onto fighters were nil. I quite agree, the RAF are not going to waste a navigator on fighters. So they put me as navigation officer here, about which I was very, very pleased, because at that stage the Japs were being pushed back and we were the only boys that could reach them. We were the only aircraft that had the range to get there. So they gave us all sorts of work, right down to torpedoes.
Yes, that was rather interesting. Catalina's carrying torpedoes. Apparently three went out and you came back at the only one.
That's right. I had a good second pilot. He brought us home.
Well, what problems did the others run into?
Well, we know one. The first one was Gordon Stilling, and he had navigation. The mines expert, Pally Carr, Lieutenant Commander Carr, was with him, and he was leaning out of the blister to watch the torpedo run when they went in. They shot him down. He just went straight into the deck. The only one, other one to get out of the kite was the poor old navigator who tried to get up through the front hatch and got chopped in half doing it. So he didn't live very long.
When you actually dropped that torpedo, what was the change in weight of the plane?
It's significant, but not enough to worry us. She's a pretty big, heavy aircraft, the old cat, and it's only a couple of thousand pounds off the wingtip, which doesn't mean that much to us. But to do it, you've got to fly at 110 feet at 110 knots, and right in front of a big naval target. That's not very funny. It's an ideal kite to drop the torpedo, but once you've dropped it, you can't get away. They hit me, and they hit the kite. They blew the great holes in it, but they didn't hit the second pilot. They didn't hit the fuel tanks.
Linherd, Catalina pilot out of Rathmines. A number of people claim there were enemy submarines off the coast. Here's George Dury.
There was supposed to have been quite a number on the coast, as a matter of fact. There were some here. They shelled Newcastle one night on a Jap sub. They put a shell right through a shed at the steelworks and it never went off. But they shelled Newcastle one night. Didn't do a lot of damage. That's the only actual time I think that there were any hostilities in this area.
Oh, yes. And a lot of ships were sunk too, off this, between Bermagui and, I would say, 200 or 300 miles north of Newcastle, quite a lot of ships sunk, merchant ships I'm talking about. Submarines were getting them.
And what was the Catalina's role in submarine detection?
Well, that was it. They used to patrol. Although we didn't sink any submarines, we'd probably frighten quite a few of them. But the main thing with the Catalina, they had such a long range, and they could cover a long distance. And this is why they used them for submarine patrol, Catalinas. And they used a small one, the Sikorsky, a float plane, but it didn't have the range.
John Newton. Joe Matthews from Wanji was asked if people were frightened when war was declared.
No, we didn't even know. We had a good time during the war. We, you know, with all the people here and that, it was quite good. A lot of social life then, because the people used to go from here over to the base. They used to have dances and things, and we used to go over there. It was quite nice.
When the Navy came to Wanji, they helped residents obtain better roads.
They had to tar the road from a Awaba to the main gate of the base at Rathmines so the lorries could come in. And there was a real lot of Air Force fellas here. And they also had the Army stationed up at number one, some of the Army in the gun pits or something up there. I believe the gun pits are still up there.
While the war was on, and up till the beginning of the war, there were only about half a dozen commercial buildings in Toronto, and things were very quiet. But with the number of people that men that went through the Rathmines air base, men with professions in various ways, they could see the opportunities of Toronto, because most of them had their families living in various places around the lake while the war was on. And when they were discharged from the Air Force, they came back to Toronto and set up business. And I think that was actually the beginning of the development of Toronto.
That final comment from Ernie Clack in his local history program, during which we looked at the years of the Second World War. For further information, contact your local branch library.